the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Politics, the budget, the pandemic, and social justice. There is a lot on California's plate. We'll hear how state and city leaders plan to sort everything out. Plus, you want to take part in a protest but are worried about the coronavirus? Well, we've got an expert with ways to stay as safe as possible while marching or standing in solidarity. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Friday. It's been a long, hard, and emotional week for all of us. Now, over the past few days on Take Two, we've heard Black voices from the community calling for change. We've heard from store owners whose businesses were ransacked by bad actors. We've heard from high school students leaving the structure of organized education to enter a world that really seems upside down right now. And most importantly, we've heard from you, sharing about the people and the things that are giving you hope during this trying time. We lean on you just as much as you lean on us. So I wanted to start today by just saying thank you. Thank you for sending us emails and tweets of encouragement. Reading them really gives us a boost, so keep them coming. You can find us on Twitter at Take Two. You know what? Email me directly at amartinez. That's amartinez at kpcc.org. Amartinez at kpcc.org. I've always said this, SoCal is strong and we're showing the world what it means to rise together. So thank you, and thank you again. All right, so we got a lot to get to today, so let's kick it off with State of Affairs. It's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. Lawmakers across the state are responding to the calls of protesters. So we're going to get into that with James Taylor. He's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. James, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Also with us, Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Marisa, welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
Good. All right. So just to start with the latest news, Governor Newsom made some important announcements earlier this afternoon regarding the moves he plans to make when it comes to law enforcement in the state. Marisa, what did you hear?
Right. So Newsom came out and said that he would like to see a statewide standard for crowd control and use of force at protests. He's directing the Peace Officer Standards and Training, POST, which is a statewide agency that oversees police training, to essentially incorporate that. And then he's also talking about asking POST to stop teaching the carotid artery hold. This is this move where police officers use their hands or their arms, or in the case of George Floyd, a knee, to try to press down on the carotid arteries and essentially cut off blood flow to the head. And this is not unique to the Floyd case that this is controversial, right? This is a hold that we've seen a lot of anger about in jurisdictions across the nation, and one that there's already legislation to ban. So Newsom says he'll be supporting that as well.
Now, James, Governor Newsom has been on a listening tour, speaking with people about all the unrest throughout the state, while we're also still experiencing a pandemic that has not gone away. How do you think he's handling the current situation?
I think he's handled the pandemic better than he's handled the unrest so far. He's sort of been on both sides as governor and as a liberal of the issue. Of course, he principally and I think morally supports what both the Occupy movement and Black Lives Matter represent in this current, conflagration. But at the same time, he's governor of the state of California, so he has to send a National Guard. And that is a real contradiction. So he's on both sides of the aisle. At the same time, he's trying to, express recognition from the state, acknowledging, as he expressed, that the activists and the issues that they are pressing actually matter. So he's, I think, deserves mixed reviews. He's been leading in the corona response. He and Governor Cuomo have been sort of the, bi-coastal leaders of the country as it relates to the reaction, and California's large population doesn't have nearly the contagion and effect that it should have compared to its population. So Gavin Newsom, I think, comes out looking good on corona, and the script is not finished yet on the police reaction.
James, let me ask you this, because Gavin Newsom is not new to us in California. He's the governor, he was lieutenant governor, he was a mayor of San Francisco, and police brutality has been around a lot longer than this coronavirus. So is part of the reasoning that he has known about police brutality, it's something that's not new, and it's something that shouldn't be catching anyone in politics off guard?
Right. And especially as mayor of a city, you know, you deal with nuts and bolts issues, service delivery issues, municipality issues at a more immediate level than you would if you were, say, a senator. And so for that reason, Gavin Newsom would have a certain insight in terms of nuts and bolts issues and how things, you know, such as police policies at the city level would play out. So he's probably the most qualified person to understand all of these issues at every level of you know, capacity in terms of understanding them.
All right, now to go ahead, Marisa, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I've covered Newsom, James and I have both been in San Francisco since he's been mayor, and I think that you do see, I think that he has always tried to straddle this line, and I think he has gone farther left, to be fair, than a lot of his colleagues, even within the Democratic Party, including Senator Kamala Harris, who we might talk about. You know, he appointed George Gascon as district attorney here, who's seen as a reformer and is now challenging Jackie Lacey down in L.A. for DA. He supported and helped craft the cannabis legalization measure that he framed today as a civil rights measure. He was quick to talk about some items in his budget around criminal justice reform. But I think, you know, to James's point, I mean, this none of this is new. And I think that this is what we're going to see as a real expectation by activists, the Black Legislative Caucus and others to put some of these, you know, quite frankly, platitudes into action about the racist systems he's seeing and the ways to dismantle them.
All right. Well, let's get to some of that, because a number of bills have advanced in the state legislature during this week of unrest. Some are aimed at tackling inequities. Others seek to reform police tactics. Marisa, give us an overview of what we've seen out of Sacramento this week.
Right. So we've seen a couple of introductions. I mentioned the carotid artery ban. We're also seeing word that there's going to be legislation crafted around limiting the use of projectiles like rubber bullets at protest. And then there were two bills that did get out of appropriations this week. One would essentially ask voters to weigh in on affirmative action at state agencies and universities. And the other would create a task force for some sort of reparations proposal. It's very sort of vague at this point. And the idea would be for a group to come together and put forward some more concrete proposals for reparations for African Americans in California.
Now, earlier this week, I spoke with Shirley Weber, the San Diego Assemblywoman behind the reparations bill, and she was sure to point out that it doesn't just mean giving money to people whose families were enslaved. Let's listen to a clip of that.
I don't know whether money does it. It may be educational opportunities. It may be that every child who's a descendant of slaves in California gets a chance to go to university free. Maybe we have a whole program to talk about home ownership and talk about ways in which the state can basically help people get homes, because that introduces you into the world of wealth.
So, James, when we hear people talk about the word reparations, I think, you know, they think direct payments, almost like a stimulus check, for lack of a better word. Is Assemblywoman Weber taking the right approach in your view?
I think it's profoundly ignorant to even discuss checks and reparations together. I think when someone does that, they show you that they don't know what they're talking about. Reparations is comprehensive and total. It would be the equivalent of waking up every day knowing that the government is on your side. That's reparations. Reparations is Mr. Aubrey jogging down the street, being killed as a young white boy by three Black men, and his mother knowing that they are going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Beginning that moment, they're arrested. That's reparations. Reparations is being able to sleep at night and not worrying about the police coming into your home. So people continue to define reparations in the most, I think, racist way to talk about checks, because nobody else talked about Native Americans' checks when they got reparations, or the Japanese when they got reparations for internment in 1989, 1991, or the survivors of the Holocaust. Nobody talks about their money. But when it comes to Blacks and reparations, people want to talk about their money. When this has to do reparations, in other words, I don't think anybody in California knows anything about reparations outside of the received knowledge, which was basically a 1960s idea of cutting a check for everybody. We're in 2020, and the reality of the reparations movement and what it's really about is so much deeper. Even when they had the congressional hearing, I was like, why do they have Danny Glover, a Black conservative who's Puerto Rican, denying his own Black identity, who's 25 years old and doesn't know anything about reparations, and Candace Owens? Nobody's really serious about having a conversation about reparations in America. So, it's a game.
So, James,
because if you're serious, it's a total program of, in other words, many Americans and Californians vote billions of dollars to keep the prisons and the jails and the police and the military apparatus going. Those same people will allow billions to be done to keep African Americans incarcerated in the mass incarceration system. But those same Americans and Californians will not allow those same billions to be given affirmatively, for example, to a black boy, give him $200,000 on day one when he's born so he can have a positive life rather than underdeveloped.
So James, we're putting aside sure. then the check, the money part of this. What would be part of this aside from cash?
It would be a complete comprehensive super fund that would fund everything. Evanston, Illinois is the model. If you look at Evanston, Illinois, and San Francisco, I think, is trying to follow it now. But Evanston, Illinois recently came up with a marijuana tax that will only go to African Americans in the ways that other school districts have used other types of taxes for school districts or, you know, public works. So Evanston, because it has decided that these are not slavery reparations, but war on drugs reparations, related to specifically how marijuana was used to underdevelop the Black Evanston community in terms of housing and every other area. So they reasoned, the city council in Evanston, where Northwestern University is, that they will specifically fix that by helping African Americans with a $10 million fund. And right now, I met with people yesterday in San Francisco. Shimon Walton is having a meeting, and also London Breed. They're actually coming together to follow the LAPD model of redistributing, you know, millions of dollars to the Black community, as LAPD apparently did this week.
We're talking State of Affairs with Marisa Lagos, hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED, and James Taylor, professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. Now, Marisa, meanwhile, national level, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy have both spoken about a police reform bill that we'll see maybe as early as next week. What have they said and what might be in it?
Well, Pelosi's talking about a really comprehensive package that she says would aim to deal with excessive force and racial profiling across the nation. The Congressional Black Caucus and others have already put out dozens of bills for years, including ones to ban that carotid chokehold we just talked about, eliminate military-grade equipment used by police forces, which we've seen out in force this past couple weeks. And then Kevin McCarthy, who is not usually game to work with Speaker Pelosi, I think we should note, has talked about maybe tying federal funds to better police training and some sort of attempt to ensure that bad officers can be removed. And there's actually some talk in the GOP of a proposal to reform this qualified immunity law that's essentially made it impossible for families to sue officers who feel like they are victims of police brutality. So it is interesting to me. These are definitely proposals that go further on the Republican side than I might have expected a couple weeks ago. But, you know, the devil is always in the details, and I think the question also becomes, is there any appetite for this in the Senate? There is obviously an election coming up fast, and I think some of that will depend on the pressure you're seeing from, you know, diverse communities across the nation.
You know, and McCarthy did suggest tying federal funds to better police training, ensuring that bad officers can be removed. Analysis from the LA Times back in 2018 showed that about 42% of LA city court settlements were for the LAPD. Marisa, does training seem like a clear middle ground that House Republicans could get behind purely just for financial reasons?
I mean, sure. And also for political reasons, right? Because as we've seen here, one of the big sticking points last year in a bill to try to make it easier to prosecute police officers and change the standard of, you know, legal use of force against civilians was essentially railroaded to some extent by police unions who were like, no, just train us better. So that's not to say training is important. I think it is. And I think that people across the sort of political spectrum who study these issues agree with a need for not just better training, but standards, right? So that every police union or every police department is held to the same place. I would not expect, though, if that is as far as Congress goes, that that is going to quell these protests or make the people in the streets and quite frankly, in our case, in state houses happy, because it is not going to be the end all and be all solution to James's point to what's really a more broadly racist system, particularly when you look at policing.
And James, Democrats led by the Congressional Black Caucus are eyeballing a dozen bills that have existed for years, such as legislation to ban the chokeholds, as we mentioned, eliminating military-grade equipment used by police. Many of those bills do not have a single GOP sponsor. How do you explain this dynamic where Republicans are seemingly willing to pick up some policing bills but reluctant to pick up the ones that tell departments what to do?
That's a great question. And I think a lot of it obviously comes from the politics of money behind the scenes and union pressures. I would imagine, you know, the different elements that lobby for different kinds of contracts related to punishment and policing. But I think it's also important to recognize that the Congressional Black Caucus has been on the right side of all of these issues all along. You know, even with the controversial 1990s crime bill, you know, most Black community members did want some kind of a, you know, strong measure to deal with the crack epidemic in the 1990s and the war, I mean, the violence that attended to it. But the long list of bills that the Congressional Black Caucus has before it, again, they reiterate the CBC agenda. None of it is new except to address, you know, the most immediate emergency response. I was sort of surprised last Sunday night, I believe it was, when there seemed to be so much chaos going on that no members of the Congressional Black Caucus actually came out in the national media to try to take an opportunity to urge calm. And I thought that was surprising that even a Maxine Waters, for example, never stood up in the middle of that vacuum.
Why do you think that didn't happen?
I think everyone was just stunned. We all were. Everybody was sort of like Rodney King when Daryl Gates did not respond right away. Everybody had that same reaction this time. I was in LA in 92 and I was here in 20 in the Bay Area. And it felt like the same sort of delayed reaction. Like everyone was sort of, you know, in a sort of slow motion trying to figure out, okay, what is happening here? And before you know it, it was a full-fledged rebellion.
And one thing we've seen this week, police unions gotten a lot of focus. They're the ones that help police maintain something called qualified immunity that shields officers from civil lawsuits from victims of police brutality or their families. James, how would you characterize the role that unions play when it comes to unarmed killings of people of color?
I mean, they play all of the influencing behind the scenes here in San Francisco, in New York, with Mr. Kelly. They're well known. But I think it's also important, you know, just sort of to recognize that they are always going to support, you know, the line officer politically and in media, even as you saw certain acts made and a lot of reactions happen to all of the violence right now. We see in Minnesota, for example, the state of Minneapolis is now investigating the Minneapolis Police Department, and across the board where there's an initial response to what appears to be a problem in American policing is that, you know, people have come up across the board at the national, state, and local level with efforts to rein law enforcement in. And I think we're about to witness a revolution in policing akin to what we had that held pretty well between 92 and 2008 between Rodney King and Oscar Grant. From Oscar Grant on, from 08 to now, we've been in 12 years of police high-profile unarmed shooting of African-American men, women, and young people, as well as Latinos and poor whites. And it's obviously exposed a real problem. And the uprising or the current rebellion is exposed that our young people are on the march to trying to lead to reform on the national and local level.
Now, one of the things we've seen, though, is unions are also major backers of Democrats. Marisa, you think maybe Republicans might try to seize on this opportunity to maybe push Democrats to weaken unions?
I think that if Democrats are appearing to be successful in weakening police unions specifically, that's absolutely possible. But I really think it's important to note, I mean, we talk a lot about labor like it's a monolith, and it's not. Let's be clear. Police unions, I mean, one of the biggest reasons that we have prison overcrowding in California were ballot measures that were almost wholly financed by the Correctional Guards Union. These are the prison officers, right? And so that happened through the 90s and 2000s. I think that we have seen some of that change in California. I don't think that these unions have the power they did at the state level maybe 10 or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, but they're still very powerful in communities, and it's not always a partisan issue. You often see both Democrats and Republicans you know, wanting to stand with the police, and I think historically there's a culture that has backed that sort of political calculation, but you know, I think the question here isn't those, in some ways, those broader pushes or if people are going to argue over unions. A lot of this is happening at the local level. I mean, you can pass state and national laws, but these individual contracts really stipulate a lot of the questions that we're talking about. And I think it's going to really be up to mayors, to city councils, and to communities to push their local leaders to change these contracts, which police officers have fought vociferously against.
Now, James, one of the things we've seen this week in regards to the protests is an announcement by L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti. He says he's going to slash $150 million from the LAPD budget and use that money to invest in education, health, jobs within the city's Black communities. What do you make of this development?
I think it's excellent. I am actually, like I said, I've been meeting with several people here in San Francisco trying to actually follow the LAPD model. I'm trying to actually get the Black community to organize itself so that it could put pressure on the city leaders to ask for the same thing. We have a fund that I helped write years ago called the Slavery Disclosure Ordinance in San Francisco. So San Francisco has a pre-existing apparatus for reparations, and that's why it's important to me because I helped write the legislation. There's actually a fund that could be invested into now. So LAPD, SFPD could actually, donate that money now because that money was supposed to be used for the African-American community for education and other, housing and other, pressing needs. So that would be, I think, a profound a second foot of the reparations issue. I mean, I see that. What LAPD is doing is fundamentally reparations. It's repairing. It's fixing. I think we're getting stuck on the word.
Well, it's the city. It would be the city. It would be the city doing it, not LAPD. I don't think LAPD wants to lose $150 million.
Oh, I see. I see. Oh, okay. Then I misunderstood that because I thought it was initiated by LAPD.
No.
Then I would assume the SFPD isn't eager either.
James Taylor is a professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. Marisa Lagos hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. James, Marisa, have a great weekend.
You too, eh?
Thank you.
All right, you want to take part in a protest but are worried about the coronavirus. I mean, we've been told for months to avoid crowds and only be close to people you've been quarantined with or family. Well, we've got an expert that'll tell us ways to stay as safe as possible while marching or standing in solidarity. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength. Don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. We're entering the 10th day of protest today with more planned for the weekend. People in all 50 states of our country have participated in the peaceful demonstrations, but we have to remember that we're also still in a pandemic. So with more activity on the horizon, we ask if you wish to participate, how to do so while staying healthy. Dr. Edward Charles Jones Lopez is an assistant professor of medicine and infectious disease specialist at Keck Medicine of USC and an epidemiologist. He joins us now for some best practices. Doctor, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure. Thanks for being here. Now, first off, help us assess the risk here. If someone is considering going out to peacefully protest, how much of a risk are they taking on when it comes to the coronavirus?
Sure. So, yeah, it's a key question in this moment. No? So over the last 6 months or so, we've really learned a lot with this virus and how it's transmitted, and so on. And a recent study has really shown something that is very important, really, as it relates to this discussion, which is an analysis of a few hundred episodes of transmission, and all except one occurred indoors. And what that suggests is something we knew already, because a lot of the data we have and thought about this virus is really an extrapolation of what we knew with influenza, how it's transmitted and so on. Yeah? So this study really just confirmed what we thought we knew, which is that most of the transmission occurs through respiratory secretions. Yeah? Mm. And those are mostly droplets. There's still a big question about maybe a subgroup of patients, maybe a small group of patients producing aerosols. And that would be a very complicated issue to discuss if it is true, but we don't really know yet. So assuming all the transmission is through droplets, the issues you need to think of is the fact that you're outdoors, particularly in a windy day, that alone is going to be very, very good, obviously. But the two things you could modify is, one, using masks, and the more people use masks, the better, obviously.
Did you say being outdoors, if it's windy, would be risky?
No, it's actually very good.
Oh, it's good. So, okay. It dilutes the virus. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, it's really about this issue of the virus traveling from one person to the next, you know? And just the fact that it's outdoors, plus any drafts or wind, you know, that would help reduce that probability. No? Now, that is something you cannot control. I mean, if you're lucky enough and it's a windy day, that's very good. If not...
Doctor, real quick, on the wind issue, it sounds like a weird question. Is it best to try and not be downwind from someone?
Yeah, I mean, so those are the difficulties, and that's related to the other two points I was going to say. So... you know, you, typically what you want to do with these drafts is try and direct wind away from people, you know, or a draft or whatever. In this case, we're talking about, you know, thousands, potentially thousands of people congregating in relatively small spaces. And that's very difficult to do, you know. So what I really would urge people to do is to think of two things. One is to use masks, you know, a single person using masks, or even 20% or 30 or 50% is maybe less likely to interrupt transmission. But the more people wear them, the better. You know, it's not only one person, but really collective protection between all of us. No? And then the second thing is really trying to stay in an area, even if you're surrounded by hundreds, if not thousands of people, try and decrease the density around
you. That's the tough part, doctor, right? Because if it's a protest, people are going to be right next to each other.
That is correct. It's also true. For example, a few days ago, accompanied my daughter who wanted to participate in the protest, and I did notice two things. One is the enormous majority of people did wear a mask, which was very reassuring, including obviously myself and my daughter and so on. But also you could find places, if you look for them, where the density, the sheer density of people was decreased. No? I think we're all collectively aware of the importance of keeping a safe distance even within a march. And I think there was already some thought in that particular march where I participated that it was very clear that people had that in their mind.
We're talking to Dr. Edward Charles Jones Lopez about safely protesting in a pandemic. Okay, what about things to have on you when you're out protesting?
What do you mean, in terms of clothes and so on?
No, in terms of like things to help maybe reduce in, you know, the possibility of infection, things that'll protect people.
Yeah, I mean, other than the mask, so the way I like to say it is you have to think of things that would decrease transmission and other things that could potentially increase transmission. Yeah? So in terms of decreasing transmission, it would be, again, the wind, you know, using masks. Now, on the other side, things that could increase transmission, one is what we just discussed, the sheer density of people around you. The other thing is typically, at least in protest, a lot of people are either shouting or, you know, sometimes removing their masks to express their thoughts. And sometimes that includes shouting. And just the fact of shouting, that's where you can see this generation of these droplets, you know. So that's sort of, it's really a balance between factors in favor and factors that, you know, protect you.
And you know what, Doctor, one of the things we've seen too is that it's been recommended that people monitor symptoms possibly after being exposed to large protest group. Can you remind us what symptoms to look out for?
Yeah, that is a very important point. And I would also go back and just say, you know, obviously people who are symptomatic that either know have the virus or even suspect of having the virus, I would, you know, this is part of the individual responsibility we're all very important that we do, would not be a good idea for them to attend the march in the first place. Yeah. Now, in terms of what to follow, I mean, the typical symptoms you have after an infection is, you know, we've been discussing this over time. It's really a flu-like illness. You know, it's a little fever sometimes, a little sore throat. You just feel unwell, you know. In general, you can have muscle aches, you know, and so on. So very, you can't really distinguish the symptoms for this infection from the flu. Yeah?
Let me ask you one thing. Well, in the time we have left, Barbara Ferrer has recommended that people who participate in a protest quarantine themselves 14 days. What do you think? Is that doable, realistic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult answer. It's, you know, I can see how you can argue for something like that. But, you know, if you really were to propose to quarantine, what is it, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people because of this, just a shared exposure, I can see how that really easily can become, you know, unreasonable.
What about getting a test after you've been out in a crowd? If you're exposed on, say, Sunday, how long would it show up in your body? Is it worth getting tested right away if you go to a protest?
No. The test only makes sense in the context of having symptoms.
Okay.
Now there's this push, particularly in LA, to try and identify as many asymptomatic, in the absence of symptoms. You know, we now know an important proportion of patients can have the virus and not have any symptoms. And there's this push towards testing both symptomatic and asymptomatic patients. But in general terms, you know, doing a test really should be based on symptoms or a particular exposure of interest. Yeah. Now, you could argue that an exposure to a march would be an exposure of interest. But again, if we are, you know, doing this in a reasonable way, you know, decreasing density in a windy day or outdoors at least, and using a mask in a homogeneous way, you know, in general, the cumulative effect of those things should, at least in theory, significantly decrease the opportunity for infection.
That's Dr. Edward Charles Jones Lopez, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at Keck Medicine of USC and an epidemiologist. Doctor, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
More Take Two coming up in just a few minutes. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Ever since the death of George Floyd and the protests that have followed, our country has been engaged in conversations about race, social justice, protesting, and policing. On Take Two, we started the week with a segment on how to talk with kids about all of this. And we're going to revisit an expanded version of that conversation now. Our guest is Amber Coleman Mortley. She's a director of social engagement at iCivics. That's the nonprofit that promotes civic engagement among children and educators. She's also a parenting expert with the NBC News Project Parent Toolkit. Amber has three children, ages 12, 11, and 9. And the four of them recently started a podcast together called Let's K-12 Better. We'll begin this conversation with how Amber and her daughters discussed the protests that began last weekend.
So we've talked a bit about George Floyd. We went on Snapchat and looked at Snap stories from what's happening on the ground with protesters who are on Snapchat across the country. We always have conversations about race because our identity is an important part of who we are. We can't get around that, right? Like, we can't not be ourselves. And so, you know, a lot of times there are situations and scenarios that, you know, people are like, oh, that's not even related to race, but for us, it actually is.
Now, on this note, you and your kids recently started a podcast where you talk about a lot of different stuff.
What do you think if a parent has a middle schooler and they haven't talked about race yet?
If you have a middle schooler and you haven't even mentioned race in your household, I'm honestly disappointed.
Why?
Because if your child, like me, has a phone and they're on social media, they're on TikTok, they're probably already seeing racial and racist things on the internet, and you're not there. So it's better if you, beforehand, before you let them go off on their own, tell them about it so that they're not surprised when they see it.
That's a very great point. What do you want to add?
If you have a middle schooler that, like, has, and you haven't talked about race, any time is still a good time to start, like, just because they have left elementary school and they're on social media and stuff doesn't mean that you can't still talk to them about race. It's like, until they leave your house, you can still talk to them and you can still give them that lesson so that they're not ignorant when they leave your house.
How different do you think your conversations are as an African-American woman as opposed to a white woman who wants to have these conversations with her kids?
I think they're the same, right? In some ways, all families want their kids to experience safety, love, security, belonging, right? Feel respected. So in that way, the social emotional learning type of conversations are the same. The things that are a little bit different are, you know, when we talk about, well, statistically, how does this impact, you know, our community? I think it's important for a white mom to have that conversation and try to center, you know, like, what would a Black mom have to say to her son or daughter, right? Like, you know, my daughters play lacrosse. So, like, you know, their teammates are white and Black. And, you know, so, like, if you have people in your lives that are not the same race as you, right? If you're supportive of that person, if you're a teammate of that person, if you're a classmate of that person, a coworker of that person, you know, you have to think, how am I being, you know, an advocate for making their life better? What am I doing to support them? How am I trying to center what I know about race in America so that I may be a better coworker, friend, teammate, classmate to this person? So, you know, in many ways, we do want to have white moms, you know, not, you won't be able to completely understand. And I think, you know, standing in solidarity with someone does not require you to fully understand race in America or how someone is living or their experience, but you do want to have the empathy there to be able to connect with, I can see how this could impact this person in this way.
Now, Amber, you mentioned how you were watching some Snapchat videos with your daughter about everything that has happened over the last few days and this weekend. Peaceful protests, but then some ended up with police aggression, vandalism, looting. How did you separate these two very different issues for kids who might just see them as one thing that happened this weekend?
As we were sitting there together, and I definitely, you know, encourage families who their children are old enough to do so, you know, to look at protest from the perspective of the individuals who are down there, right? So we compared stories. In some places, the stories were extremely peaceful. People were on the side of the road. They had their signs. Cars were, you know, honking and driving by in solidarity. People were cheering. People were singing, right? In some places, the police joined in with the protesters and were standing together in solidarity. You know, we saw that on Snap stories. You know, and then obviously in other Snap stories, we saw more violence, which my, you know, my children were like, oh my God, like, what is this? Like, why is it like this? what's most important is to allow your child to process and ask them questions about what are the differences that you see, right? We want children to grow up to be critical thinkers. We want them to analyze the media that they consume. So that would be the first thing, right? And then the second thing is, you know, understanding how a protest can go from being peaceful and then moving into something that is violent, something that it was not intended to be, right? We all are in scenarios in our life where something starts off great and then, you know, oh my goodness, it just took a wrong turn. You know, how do we bring it back? How do we pull people together? How do we send a message that, you know, maybe this is not what we're trying to accomplish?
Talking to Amber Coleman-Mortley. She's the director of social engagement at iCivics. So then, Amber, then so in the micro, what happened this weekend is one thing. But in the macro, the larger issues of race and policing in America, how do we even begin to talk with kids about that? Because that could take months, years, decades to really hash out this conversation. And with kids, they grow up.
I think the most important thing is for parents to become an avid reader in anti-racist theory, ideology, and practice, right? There's a lot of books. You can even Google search, you know, how do I become an anti-racist? And this is for not just white families, non-Black families of color, and even Black families, right? If you want to make this better, if you want to have these conversations with your kids, read them with your family, right? Have a book club with your family. I would also encourage, like, history and civics are extremely important in changing the course and direction of where we are going as a country. You know, I tell my children all the time, when the Constitution was signed, our ancestors were considered, you know, 3/5 value of a white male, right? We need to contextualize and be able to grapple with the complexities of history and tell full, complete stories. And then also tell narratives that are overcoming, right? Like, we don't wanna focus on, when we're thinking about the long story of, like, race in America, we don't wanna always focus on the negative portions of it. We do wanna focus on how did individuals solve the problems that they were experiencing as communities or within their community? How did they use the Constitution to do that? How did they use the justice system? How did they use peaceful protests? How did they work together across cultural and cross racial groups to push the needle on equality and have America to stand up for the principles in which it's so beautifully has out here for us to actually actualize?
But Amber, let me ask you this then. So when you're sitting down and going over this history, how far do you take it in terms of the terrible stuff? Because there are things that you could show your kids that are just as horrific as anything in human history. So how do you know what's age appropriate and how far to push it to make the point of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I would definitely say age appropriate content is super important. And there are a lot of great resources out there. I would connect with your child's teacher to ask them, like, well, what are they learning in class? I would also go back to, you know, with middle school, I think middle schoolers can grapple with complex issues. High schoolers can definitely grapple. You have kids who are in AP US history, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, who are working on these things in their school right now, who are thinking about these questions in a complex and very sophisticated way right now, right? You know, so you can have these conversations with your 6th through 12th grader pretty easily. You know, imagery, obviously, that is something that you as a parent, but, you know, if you're going to watch rated R movies with your kids, you can also share some of these images that are not as brutal with your children, right? Like, if your kid is watching a rated R movie, you need to think of it in that context. Like, what am I protecting them from if I've allowed them to watch a rated R, right? So I was like, well, if I let my kid watch this, then I definitely can think about this human rights issue and talk to them about it and be very realistic about it and show them this imagery. And then have a conversation, because again, if you do not have the conversation, you're doing far more harm than good.
One more thing, Amber, fine, you know, because this is all really intense and it's been going on for days now. So how do you and your kid take care of yourselves when the news cycle is so seemingly overwhelming these days?
Yeah, I would say lean on the people in your, you know, your close-knit circle. You know, I have had lots of allies of all races who've been like, hey, do you need anything? Are you okay? You know, now is not a moment for us to focus on, you know, well, I'm a Black person and this is like, you know, I'm feeling this and I'm going to feel this by myself. You know, if I have friends who are white or non-Black, but they're still a person of color and they're willing to get in here with me, then come on in, right? Like, let's do this together, because healing is required right now as a nation, and we are not going to heal if we don't do it together.
Amber Coleman Mortley, mother and podcaster. Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Amber's podcast with her daughters is called Let's K-12 Better. And for more ideas on how to help kids understand race in America and the current protests, just go to our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Coming up, we're going to stick with kids because they have a lot of questions all the time. So we're going to stick with kids and how to help them understand everything that's happening in this world. And with all the protests, that's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. We've been talking with experts and parents about how they're handling the times with their children. Tanette Powell is both. She directs the UCLA Parent Empowerment Project and has three sons, 5-year-old Jordan, 9-year-old Joa, and 10-year-old JJ. For the last month, she's encouraged them to create what she calls freedom dreams.
What I love about Freedom Dreams is it's something that's super academic. And there's a book called Freedom Dreams that was written by Robin Kelly at UCLA. But Freedom Dreams is such a simple concept that a 5-year-old can understand, or a 50-year-old. And it's really this idea that Black people have not only come together around a struggle, they've also come together around this idea that there was something better, right? That there was something more that we wanted. So even though there's been a struggle there, there's also been this radical element of, you know, being able to come together because we believe that we could have better.
Powell says there's value in this exercise for every family, no matter where they come from. Freedom dreams can be expressed in poems, paint, movement, really almost any medium. To help us show it off, she had her older sons write their dreams down, and then she recorded them reading. Powell shared those videos with us on our website, laist.com, and here are her sons, starting with her oldest, JJ.
Yeah, so I want to talk about your freedom dreams. So let's talk about for yourself. What does that freedom dream look like for you?
Being able to break out of a shell, not just going under someone else's command. Like, not one person leading us, a community leading us.
What is that collective freedom dreams for the world or for our country?
The collective freedom dreams for the world and for the country, it would be like no more police brutality.
Yeah.
Giving more money to like people who don't have money.
Right. Thank you.
How old are you, Jordan?
4.
What? How old are you?
4.
You're not 4.
5.
All right, so you're 5. So in 20 years, you're going to be 25 years old.
Yeah.
Where are you going to live?
When I'm 25, I live in Mexico.
Whoa, okay, you're gonna live in Mexico. What's gonna be your work? What are you gonna do? What's gonna be your job?
My job? I'll be doing marathons.
You're gonna be doing marathons? Whoa, you're gonna be living in Mexico. They're gonna be paying you to do marathons. Okay, all right. Are you gonna have any pets? Are you gonna have dogs or something?
Yeah, I'm gonna have two dogs.
Yeah, what kind of dogs?
An English bulldog and an English bulldog.
All right, so two English bulldogs. What's gonna be their names?
Cody.
Cody and what?
Cody.
And who?
Dodie.
Dodie.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. That's cool. All right, Joa, I have a question for you. You know, we're thinking about our freedom dreams, and I just want to know, who is Joa and what is he doing?
What Joa is doing, he wants to be a wrestler.
Giving yourself a moment to dream and to feel, what does the world look like, Joa?
A beautiful place.
Tell me about that beautiful place.
It has water, it has love. It's so good to live here.
And how do people treat each other? Let's dream about that.
They treat each other like their family.
Yeah. Yeah.
With kindness, love.
Yeah. We dream of an earth that is a beautiful and fun place. Thank you, Joa.
That was Joa Powell sharing his freedom dream. His mom, Tanette, is a director of UCLA Parent Empowerment Project, and she encourages all children to express their freedom dreams. All right, now we want to hear from you. What stories are we not getting to? What voices are we not hearing from? Who would you like to hear from? Tell us. Give us a call at 626-583-5281 and leave us a message. That's 626-583-5281. All right, speaking of voices, take two. Yeah, you hear my voice, but it's made up of all kinds of different voices. So let's get to all of them that make take two happen. Our show was produced by Lori Skywalker Galaretta, Leo Duran, and Jonathan Shiflett. Austin Cross directed the show this week. Darby Maloney was our editor. Our news apprentice is Marina Pena. Our engineers were Hazmik Pogosian and Eduardo Perez. Megan Larson is our senior producer. You can go and look for our Take Two playlist on Spotify. Just look for Take Two playlist. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.